our speaker tonight, Sharon B. Sharon?
Oh, that was exciting. My name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. So much excitement. I don't know. It was nice to be able to get my chip with you. My birthday was 17 days ago, and I didn't get a chip down in Los Angeles. So it was exciting to be a part of that. Did anybody tally up all the time? That's what we do in our home group. We tally up all the birthdays. But it would be quite a celebration. But it's nice to be here, and it's nice to be with all of you. I'd like to thank Glenn for all the hospitality and the fish head soup we had at the time. I don't know. We ate good, and we had a lot of fellowship, and I met a lot of nice people, and my baby, I guess you call them sponsees, Stacy, has moved up here 9 months ago, and so we get to have fun at the Hilton later and sit up until 4 in the morning and talk about sobriety. But boy, times have changed. There have been a time the Hilton wouldn't let me stay long. I know that. I was kicked out of the Polo Lounge once in Beverly Hills for picking the flowers and handing them out to the patrons. So there was a time that nice places welcomed me, and then there was a time that nice places didn't welcome me. A lot of it was due to my alcoholism and my behavior. When I drank alcohol, I was transformed. Now, if this is going to be shown on the Playboy Channel lately, we're going to have to be transformed before he is going to like what I have to offer, I'll tell you. But, you know, the first time I drank alcohol at 13 years old, the chest fairy came. I mean, she just came. I mean, it was a night to remember, I'll tell you. I was raised in the great state of Iowa, you know, my first resentment. But now we have the Field of Dreams. It isn't heaven, it's Iowa. But I've made peace with so much of my past. I'll tell you, no matter where I drank in the world, I was always from at least Wisconsin because they had cheese. They didn't have pigs and corn. But I was never enough. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I was never enough. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, by working the steps and having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I became enough. That alone has been worth the journey here. But as I said, I started drinking at 13. I come from a normal family. If it was dysfunctional at all, it was because I was in it. I mean, that's it. I just got the opportunity to go home to my parents' 50th anniversary. They live in the same house I grew up in. I have the same parents. A lot of things are the same. And it's nice now to be able to be of service and to be a daughter that, you know, when the phone rings in the middle of the night, my mother doesn't flinch wide awake and wonder where they found me. And if nothing else in Alcoholics Anonymous, just having bridged the gap between me and my mother and father, having had the immense step change our relationship, I'm overpaid. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life that I want to live today. I really started drinking heavily when I went to college because that's what you did in my family. It was the late 60s and there was a lot going on, and I guess if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. But there's an awful lot of the 60s I remember. I started out trying to do what I thought I wanted to do. I was going to marry this guy. We were pinned. I joined a sorority. I was taking education classes. I wanted to do well and be a teacher, an art teacher. And by the time 1968 came around, I went to the Democratic National Convention. Something changed. I went there in my Bobby Brooks, you know, little outfit and my patent leather shoes and matching purse, and I even wore white gloves. I was passing out leaflets next to Paul Newman, you know, for the peace candidate. By the end of that weekend, I was following Dick Gregory to Mary Bailey's house, a joint in one hand, a bottle of Matisse in the other, you know, and when I put him down long enough, I give you the peace sign in one and the one finger in the other. The patent leather shoes were gone, the Bobby Brooks clothes never again to be worn, and the bell bottoms were on, and you know, I had a cause. And you give an alcoholic a cause, and we get loud. They love me at protest rallies because I was loud, especially with some good amphetamines under my alcohol, you know. I was loud. And so I'm back to college, and I dropped out of that lifestyle, and I started to take painting classes, and I did a lot of Jackson Pollock-type paintings with my clothes on the canvas. And I was taking a lot of amphetamines, I was smoking a lot of pot, and I was drinking in Joe's Place every day. I had a fake ID, and I drank in places like Joe's Place, the airliner, and that's what I did. And I moved into an apartment with a couple other dropouts, and we set about trying to seek truth and change the world. And, you know, I'll tell you, you can find truth on 16th Fairway Hits of Orange Sunshine, you know, which is some good stuff. But the problem is you look through the reams of paper you've been writing on, it was somewhere in that cut of the Satanic Majesty's Request. You know, the Rolling Stones found it just for a hair. And you try to find truth the next morning, and it's like, where'd it go? You know, and it was always so elusive, and I was always on a search. I was on a constant search. And thank God in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I finally found somewhere where I belong. I mean, I was a member of a lot of things, but I belong here. And my father got a little, what's the term? The term was freaked out, I think, in that era. And he brought the family priest down to try to talk to me. I had a suicide attempt. Things were getting a little strange. I was starting to dress funny. I was starting to look funny. My grades went up to par, my paintings were a little bit odd, and my father brought the priest down to try to find out what was going on with his daughter, number two, and the priest and I got roaring drunk that night, just very roaring drunk, and I remember my father's look on his face, and I walked this priest around the student union and introduced him to all my activist friends, and we were all brothers by the end of that evening, and my father just didn't know what was going on, and he would try to talk to me. They had sent me to a psychiatrist that tried to talk to me, but if you fold your arms and you got an attitude, you know, they're not going to get much out of you. And I went to a number of psychiatrists only about twice. They never asked me to come back after twice because I didn't talk. I thought you'd figure it out, we're paying you. And that was my attitude. And I started to see that look in people's eyes, you know, that look of, what's wrong with you? Why do you have to act like that? Why can't you be like so-and-so? You've got so much potential. You know, that look, and it turns into disgust sometimes, and that look just used to make me cringe. You have to have a drink after you saw that look. And but later in my sobriety, I realized what a lot of that look was, that I saw in people's eyes. It was hurt. It was just not understanding. It was sometimes compassion. But see, I have a disease of warped perspective. I have selective hearing. I am one of those people that you can say, gee, you look nice tonight. And I say, yeah, but, you know, and I'll give you a yeah, but, you know, which is all a lie after the but. But I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous to accept your gifts. And ended up in New York because my father and I had a huge fight, one that was not mendable. And I went to work for an ad agency, and that was the summer that the summer that was. I worked in downtown. I lived on the Upper West Side. I could drink now because I'm 18, and I can drink in that town anytime, anywhere. And they drank a lot in that ad agency, and we would take care of one another. We would close each other's door if we had too much to drink for lunch and help each other out. And we covered for one another, and I would take a lot of uppers to get going in the morning because the subways made me nervous, and I needed to be fortified, you know, and I had a lot of courage when I wanted combined alcohol and uppers. And I had a big bag of this LSD that summer. It was Orange Sunshine, so I kept thinking I was getting my vitamin C, you know. And I'd lick my fingers and put it in the bag and lick my fingers, and I'd go off to work, and that's what I did all summer long. And you would find me sitting in the West End getting the bumps on my head read by my local phrenologist, you know. Or you would find me walking Central Park at 4 in the morning with my costume of black on, my black hat and my long black coat. And, you know, I looked kind of ominous. And and bring people home, and we'd have a jam session, and then we'd do tarot cards, and maybe read the I Ching, and then I'd get ready, and off to work I'd go after I had some more uppers, and I did this over and over and over again, and finally I started having too many anxiety attacks. I didn't know what they were. I had a lot of anxiety attacks. I tried to take a yoga class, I thought that would help, and I would go into my yoga class smoking two cigarettes at once, and they would try to pray over me, or mantra over me, or om over me, or something over me, get me calmed down, and I was just moving too fast, and I felt like I was going to explode, and I lived in New York for a while, and I begged my father to let me go back to college, because I was tired. I was tired. And he said, okay, and we went back to college, and we went back to those art classes, and you know what? I had no more inner creativity left unless it was chemically induced. I couldn't sit down and draw a picture out of my mind like I could. I couldn't create anything like I could. It was gone. And that was very depressing for me. And me and my cat were very depressed. And I remember my father coming down to feed me some groceries because I looked a little bit gaunt. And he found me cleaning a pound of grass on the table instead of at class. And so that was it for college. He said, you're out. You know, that's it. I can't do this anymore. And I went to Colorado to be a cowboy because I thought that would fix it. You know, the book talks about taking geographics. Well, I took a lot of geographics. See, the grass is always greener. And, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I used to love to hear a speaker called Norm Alpe. Norm would pump me up for a week. I could go out and fight the tigers for a week after I heard Norm. And Norm used to say, the reason the grass is greener, Sharon, is because Eva got to care of his lawn, you know, and explained it to me. I figured out I better take care of my lawn. There's enough fertilizer on it, I know, for God's sakes, you know. Might as well make something grow. But that's the way it was for me. And I was living near Aspen, and I was doing well, and I was serving breakfast to the equestrians. That's as close as I got to being a cowboy. And in walked Bob Dylan to order a milkshake to go. And then I said, this is Bob Dylan here in this coffee shop where I am. And so I made two chocolate milkshakes to go, and I got in the car with this guy, and I said, where are we going, Bob? He said, California. I said, fine. And I'm not really sure who he was. He was kind of mysterious, but he was very spiritual, I'll tell you that. And Laguna Beach, he went his way, and I went mine, and I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach. And I came with $2. I left with $4 and a dog 4 months later. You know, I made a profit. You know, I had a good time. And but I went back to Colorado after this, you know, little respite out in Huntington Beach, and I wanted to get my things out of this cabin because I don't know where I was going or what I was doing, but somebody moved in. You know, my landlord didn't hold the cabin for me while I was gone, and when I walked into that place, and this man answering the door was wearing my dashiki, I remember that, and he was standing there with my favorite enamel coffee cup in his hand, and you know, there were my dishes there in the sink and my cooking utensils on the stove and you know, my things hanging on the wall and my pictures. And I said, excuse me, I used to live here. There's a box in the corner of my photographs. And I walked over and I got that box of photographs and I walked out the door. I got 2 feet outside that door and, well, what's wrong with you? My head said, why don't you get your things? That's what you came for. All just go back in there and get your things that belong to you. And I couldn't do it. And I felt that day that something was terribly wrong with me. I was 21 years old. I ended up living back at home with Mom and Dad that winter. And the rule was no drugs in the house because that's what they thought was ruining my life. It was okay to drink. So another rule was not to bother my father and to stay out of his way because when we would meet in the hallway, you could feel the tension. I didn't sit down and eat at the big table with them that Thanksgiving. You know, I sat with the little kids at the card table. It was very tense in my house, but I stayed out of everybody's way, and I went in the local taverns every night and drank, and I judged everybody in those taverns every night, you know, the ones from high school who never left and never got anywhere and never did anything with their life, and there I am every night judging them. But I was very ill, and they took me to the doctor, and the doctor gave me Valium for my nose because he knew the situation with my father. And what happens is I've got this blown pancreas, I've got a gallbladder that's totally non-functional, I'm a full-blown alcoholic, and they think it's my nerves, you know. And I knew something was wrong with me. I knew that there was just it was a point past no return for me. I knew that when I was 21 years old, but I did not know the disease of alcoholism, nor did everybody else. They'd since been very educated, but nobody spotted it, nobody knew to look for it, and if Sharon would just get off those drugs, maybe she'd be okay and do something with her life. After all, she's got all that potential. You know, maybe she'd meet somebody and straighten out, you know. And I knew that my life was over. And I was sitting in that tavern one night, and in walks Phil, who I'd gone to high school with. And Phil was 6 feet 8 inches tall, and he was kind of a geek. And he had changed. He had these long, curly, wonderful locks and John Lennon glasses, and he wore that Indian girl's clothing that just wafted in the wind. And he walked into his tavern in Iowa, and he looked very peaceful, you know, and he was very stoned is what he was. But he said to me, "Let me take care of you, Sharon. You look like you need to be taken care of." And those are magic words for me. I said, "What are we going to do and where are we going to go?" And he said, "We're going to go to Wisconsin. I bought a farm up there." I thought, fine, that sounds like I'll get a nice rest. And little did I know, it was 85 acres of organic land, part of an organic community in northern Wisconsin. And we cooked with wood, we heated with wood, we ground our own wheat berries to make our own bread. We had honeybees, we had 50 head of organic sheep. You know, we had to cut and split wood all the time. We made maple syrup out of the maple trees. You know, and I'm up there for a rest, and all they're doing is working. And he took away my alcohol, and he took away my cigarettes, and he gave me organic pots to smoke. And he was going to make me organic and get me well. And I thought it might work, you know, I really did. And I still was getting very, very ill, and they finally took me to the hospital one night, and they found this problem with my gallbladder and my pancreas, and the doctor said, "You're 21 years old and your body looks like an old woman. Do you abuse alcohol or drugs?" And I looked at him with every bit of honesty, and I said, "I'm organic." Yeah. Because I believed it. And you know, they did what they did, and I had some surgery, and then I started to get better, and we did Adele Davis, and you know, we bought all this organic food at this co-op in Minneapolis, and we drive home in the pickup. It was 90 miles home. I looked back and I thought, I'm never going to stay with this guy long enough to eat this food. I mean, I just knew it. And it was the second snowfall of the winter. I made a very important decision in my life. And it was one of those nights that, you know, I'm smoking the pot and it's just not calming the nerves. And I seemed to be rocking faster in the rocking chair, and the snow was coming down heavier. And the last time we were snowed in for 2 days, and how long is it going to be this time? Because we were way back there. And he was learning to play the banjo as he always was. And he had this record. You know, we didn't have a TV or any diversion, you know. And we had Mother Earth News out loud and things like that. And he was up playing his banjo with Pete Seeger, with How to Play the Banjo with Pete Seeger, and it just seemed like, you know, he'd get to that part of the five string where he tried to go bum titty bum titty, and he would miss one of the notes, and he'd, you know, the bum would go, the titty would go, and he would start that record over, you know, and Pete Seeger sounded like Big Bird, you know, and I'm rocking in this chair faster and faster, and the cat's flicking its tail, and the dog is drooling and looking at me like, do something, and the snow's getting heavy. And I'm smoking this organic pot, and it's just like nothing will do it, and the light went on. Go to town and get some booze. And I flew in that car, and I flew in. It was a one-horse town, a general store, and they had 2 gallons of wine, and I got it, and I got home before the snow got too heavy. And I put that wine on the table, and I felt better. Phil took a look at me and the wine, and he went to bed because he knew what I acted like. And I tell you, after a couple of glasses of that wine, I thought, why did I wait so long? The cat looked happy. The dog was relaxed. We were all feeling good. And I made a very important decision that night. You know, the night that he woke up and he gave me that look again. He stood there and gave me that look. And I'm having a good time, you know. I don't want to get ruined by that look. And my head said to me, it defended me. And I said, you know what? Alcohol is more fun than you, Phil. And I made a decision that night not to get thirsty again. And it was a very important decision because I threw away what I could have had. I threw away a life that I could have had. But alcohol was more important. It fixed me. That organic living didn't fix me. And alcohol did something. It filled all those holes up, and I felt like somebody. And I could dream again and have some hopes again, even if they weren't true. Alcohol did that for me. And come the next summer, he had gotten sick of me, had enough, and he left, and that was fine, because all of the organic people went to primal therapy, and I spent my money at the bars, thank you, and I screamed at the sheep, you know, it was just fine. I didn't have to go scream with each other, and I was alone, and I was happy, and I tended this half acre of marijuana we had planted before we left. We planted it, and Clarence the farmer would come visit me, and he was older, and he would come on the tractor with the bees every night, and I'd feel better when I'd see that tractor coming up the lane. And the reason he was on the tractor is because he had too many DWIs, and his license had been pulled, so he was on the tractor, you know. So Clarence would go get the bees, and he'd come up every night, and we would play Indian love songs. He liked that. I had this piano I played, so we would play these Indian love songs, and the dog would howl, and we would drink our booze, and Clarence wouldn't put in his teeth, but it didn't matter, you know. It was my party, and it was fun, and so I tended this pot and I drank with Clarence that summer, and then it was going to be winter. I could feel it coming in August, and I knew I had to do something, so I set up this big bad dope deal. I was going to sell it all one shot in this college town and split. I don't know where I'm going, but I knew I had to get out of town because I was never going to be cold again. And I harvested it for 3 days, you know, the right way. You read these books and you do it with the boiling water, and you put the roots in the boiling water. The wood stove is going out, having to close on them. Just like I'm engulfed in this organic pot, and 3 days by horseback, back and forth, you know, with this pot, and hanging it upside down in the machine shed, and wrapping it up, and just doing it all the right way. And for 3 days I did this, and I drove into Menominee in my car with my dog, and we knocked at the door, and we got in, and we made the deal, and I said, okay, where's the stuff? And I looked at my dog, and my dog looked at me, and we forgot it. We left it back on the farm, in big hefty bags, and so I did the next best thing that night. I mean, this is the keen alcoholic mind. About 2 blocks away, I saw the midway of a carnival, and I thought, I always wanted to be a gypsy. And I walked over there, and I talked to a few people, and I got a job. So me and my pot and my dog and a few clothing packed up, and we joined the carnival. And I ran a shooting gallery. And if you got a trunk full of pot, you've got instant friends, you know? So I made instant friends with everybody that had all the uppers and all the other things going on. And they drank hard and heavy, and I liked it. And you're in town for 3 days, and you blew out, and you left the mess behind you. I thought you always left the mess behind you. And my big cry was, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, it's my book I'm writing. And I hurt a lot of people, and I drug a lot of people down. And I didn't know that until I got honest with my inventory, until I was able to look at my own character defects along the way, until I was able to make that amends list. I was not able to see the people I hurt. You know, I just thought that they were insensitive to my needs. And I called my mother somewhere with, you know, when I was on the road with a show, and she started to cry. And I thought, oh, Christ, now I can't even call my mother anymore. I mean, she had to go up to Wisconsin and put all this farm stuff together and take care of the sheep and get her furniture back and take care of my mess. Somebody always had to clean up my mess. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned to be responsible for myself. And it's such a freedom. Jesus, I thought I had freedom 3 days in, blowing out of town and leaving the mess. That was not freedom. I was a prisoner of my disease and didn't know it. And I have freedom today by being responsible. Such an odd relationship, but it works for me. And so my mother crying, and I had to shut that off. Well, I just didn't want to hurt anybody, and I didn't want to hear it. And I just thought she was just oversensitive to gypsies because she was tied up once by gypsies. And, you know, I rationalized everything in my life, and what happened was, somewhere in Monroe, Louisiana, I created a little havoc on the midway. Somewhere, you know, down there, I got a little too drunk, and I brought the heat down. Somewhere down there, I ticked off the owner of the show. And somewhere in Bogalusa, near Bogalusa, Louisiana, they started to set me up for my demise, is what they did. And in Bogalusa, I opened the door one morning. Bogalusa, Louisiana, be greeted by a couple of shotguns. And they stuck them in my belly, and they searched the room, and they found what they wanted to find. And my stash was big enough to get me for sales. And so they took me and my newfound him in. And that's where you meet him, is with the carnival. And a lot of potential. And what happened was, I screamed for 4 days and finally got my rights and my phone call, and the carnival left town, and we had, my dog went to jail, and we had a pet skunk, and the skunk went to jail, and we were just all there. And somewhere in there, my brother-in-law, who I called in New York, got in touch with my father and I, and my father got on the plane and flew down. And I didn't know that, and they took me out of that jail about a week later, and they said, there's somebody you got to see somewhere. And they took me in the cop car, and I was in handcuffs when I walked into that attorney's office, and my father was sitting in that chair. And if I could have crawled under that chair and evaporated, I wish I could have, because it was a very painful meeting. And it was never my fault, ever. You know, nothing's ever my fault. And there was not much they could do, and my father could not even look at me, and I couldn't even look at him, and very little was said between the two of us. And he got on the plane and went home. And I got out 31 days later, and I found the French Quarter of New Orleans, because they said not to leave the state. Go earn some money. I was going to have to pay a big fine, do some time. They weren't sure. So I found the French Quarter of New Orleans, and I fell in love. And if you're a good alcoholic, that's the place to fall in love. And every other doorway is a bar, and you can drink with a paper cup anywhere. You can go shopping with a cup of booze. And I started to dance because it was quick money, and I danced at the 500 Club, and I would wear these funny little outfits with fishnet stockings and platform shoes and platinum blonde wigs, and my drag queen friends would make me up, and you didn't quite know what I was when I went to work. And I'd have to dance on this Baby Grand, and if you're drinking Kvassia with a bartender, the Baby Grand is pretty small for platform shoes. And I remember one night I got hung up on that palm tree that was on the wall, you know? There were some staples in it, and those fishnets wouldn't come loose, you know? And so I'm trying to slither around, and the Alabama football team was out there that night. It was during Mardi Gras or something, and they wanted a show, you know? And I'm stuck on this palm tree. So I just decided to rip it away, and I did. And I'm a toxic alcoholic woman. I do not get thin. I get bloated and kind of flabby when I drink, and I remember it seemed like my whole thigh just kind of went out the side of the fishnet. That was humiliating. That definitely was humiliating. Well, I shortly thereafter asked for a raise, and they said, you have to be kidding. And so I became a bartender, and I was a good bartender. And I worked at a place called the Downtowner, which was a nice bar and a nice hotel. And me and the general manager would drink green chartreuse all day long. And he got fired for being drunk on the job. And guess who was next? I got fired. That's the numbers. I quit, you're fired. You want your paycheck signed here. And my name got put into a computer, and I got blackballed from other nice places to work because I tried applying, and they said, sorry. So I started working the local joints. And it's better anyway because, you know, you come into my bar, and, you know, Billy from the Bastille, when I get off, I'm going to your bar at the Bastille, and you're going to take care of me just like I took care of you. You got a tab, I got a tab. You want to pass out for a while, I'll watch your money. You know? And the same thing goes when I go to your bar. And my alcoholism is going fast and furious with me. I this carnival boyfriend and I lived together for 2 years, and he would work the tugboats, and he would come home at odd hours, and I was never quite sure when he was coming home, and he was finding with my new best friend, and I try to explain to him that, you know, like, he's Gil, the one-armed sea captain. You should hear him sing to have and have not, and I get punched in the face, you know. And he just had no romance about him, and he had a heroin habit. When he'd pass out, he'd get a black eye, you know. I'd wait for that moment, and it was true love. You know, it was exciting, and my parents came to visit me when I lived with this guy. We lived above the Mousetrap, which is a biker bar on Lower St. Peter Street. And in the first apartment, there's a tar paper roof. They're all grungy and dirty. And, you know, it was the bartender who drove his bike up the steps through the screen door and left it, you know. And the second apartment was Angela. And she was a lady of the evening, let's say. And she worked nights. And then there was me and Kirby and all of the fun stuff that went on. And and my mom and dad knocked at the door. I was very surprised. And this guy put the snake in my father's face because we had a pet snake. And that didn't get us off to a good start. And my mother heard him call me all those nice four-letter words in front of her, you know, not dear and love. And I took us out to eat, and my mother tried to talk to me, I remember, and my dad just clenched his jaw all night long. That's all he did. And my mother had tears going into her baked potato. I'll never forget that. And when they left that day, you know, they said goodbye to daughter number two, or any resemblance to the one that used to light up the room when she walked in the room. They said goodbye to her, and I'm a mother to them, and I can't even imagine what I put my parents through. But I was tired, and I really wanted to go with them. But I knew it wouldn't change. I absolutely knew nothing would change. I had very, very little hope left in my life at that point. And I had a ways to go yet. And it was the last time I saw my parents until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day, a lot, big piece of me died that day when they walked away. And now I have even more of a reason to put on the black cloak and to wear the black hat and to be maudlin and morbid if the mood strikes me with gin like it always did. But most of the time I was drinking Jose Cuervo Gold, you know, that was my thing. You know, I liked Harley Davidson's and The Cure because, you know, things happened right now when you did those things. You know, instant gratification was too slow, and I wanted things to happen now. And my jobs got into parts of town that weren't much fun and places that you could smell walking down the street. And I was at Mardi Gras one year, and I had just gotten off, and I was kind of in a brownout, and my friend Michael, who was the bouncer at Pat O'Brien's, was with me, and we were partying and having a good time, and we were going to my house to finish the party. It was Mardi Gras Day, and I remember walking on the street with him, coming out of a blackout and seeing him with a gun in somebody's face. So I said, Michael, put your gun away, it's Mardi Gras Day. I mean, that's how I treated the whole situation. And so he put his gun away, and he went back to my place. I went out for some more booze. I came back. I guess he had been taking pot shots at people off my balcony. This was not Michael's normal behavior. He was a very friendly, upbeat guy. And I have to believe it was the disease of alcoholism. And the police were called, and Michael was standing at the top of my stairs, and he leveled the gun, and Michael was blown away that morning. And I'm 2 feet inside the door coming out of a blackout as I hear the shots, and I was the last person to talk to this man alive, and I don't remember what was said. And the way I dealt with that day was I saw everybody who hit the deck, and I looked at all of them, and I said, I'm taking a bath. And I ran in the door and closed the door, and I went and started to run a bath water and made the police break down the door to get to me. And they took me to interrogate me that day because this whole thing was, you know, it was a homicide, and they had to treat it as such. And I sat there on the third floor of the New Orleans Police Department watching the Mardi Gras floats go down. I was very, very drunk. I had taken something else, of course, to party, and I felt like I was going to fly apart, and that there was nothing holding me together that day. And I ended up on a plane going to New York. And I sat in my sister's second bedroom, and I closed the door, and I drank Jack Daniels, and I couldn't get out. And some people I had known said they wanted me to sketch the Indians. We were going to go write a book about Indians, and they got some money. And there was a writer, a photographer, and me, and so they picked me up, and we didn't even get out of Greenwich Village that day because we were drinking so much. And I was such a downer for these people that they left me. They left me in Annapolis and felt bad and came back and got me. I was always in a hangover, always in a blackout. I was always sick, and they were trying to teach me how to pace my drinks. They tried to help me control and enjoy my drinking, and it was impossible. I had no more control over my alcohol. And we got to Southern California, Barney's Deanery, and I didn't know that they closed the bars. And there's a bar in West Hollywood that's called Barney's Deanery, and it's a very sick place. And a lot of the people that survived from that bar are sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And they carried me off the bar still screaming because they had last call, and I didn't understand that. You know, I wasn't prepared. And I tried to work. They hired me as a cocktail waitress down the street for about 10 minutes, and I said, sorry, lady, we don't want you back. My mind was gone. I couldn't remember what I had in my hand or where I was going or what I was doing. I bloated up to 170-plus pounds of just toxicity and mess and disease, and I had spots on my face that never went away. I wasn't sure I was going to sleep that night if where I was staying was now, you know, off limits. And And it didn't matter. I just wanted to just have something work and shut off my head, because my head was telling me what a loser I was all the time. I caught a glimpse of me in a corner shop window, and I didn't even believe that it was me. I thought, who is that derelict person? And it was me. And I went back to New Orleans, and I couldn't get my old job back on Lower Decatur Street, the one you could smell walking down the street. They didn't want me back. I met somebody going to Hawaii, and I said, let's go. I am on the move for myself, because even when I look in that back bar mirror, there's no more magic. In West Hollywood again, and this guy sobered up and saw what he had. Somewhere in Texas, I had DTs and scared the crap out of him, and he went his way and left me at Barney's Beanery, and I didn't know what I was going to do or why I was there, but I didn't care anymore. And a couple of guys asked me to go to Palm Springs, and they had Harleys, and I said, sure. So I got on the back of the Harley, and I found out when we hit Palm Springs bar, they asked me, because it was windy going through the desert that night, so they called the fattest one out of the bar to sit on the back tire. I had become the lower companion, and hurt my feelings. But I met two more friends that night, as we're capable of doing, except they weren't so friendly, and they took me somewhere, and I came out of the blackout with them kicking me in the face. And somewhere in the course of that evening of rape and breaking my jaw in three places and breaking my nose and beating me up very badly, I just stopped screaming and I stopped caring. And they took me out of town, and it was July 27th, it was hot, it was the desert. They rolled me off the side of the road, and I'm face down in the sand, and I have a concussion, and I'm in and out of a blackout, and I'm bleeding out of my face, and I came to when I heard the car door slam and then drive away, and I heard a voice. And the voice wasn't my own, because I don't believe in what was about to be said to me, which was, get up, I want to live. And it was a loud voice, and it got me up, it woke me up, and I got up the side of that hill, and I walked down this blacktop road, and I found a condominium, and I passed out in a lawn chair by the pool, and about a foot away from the pool. And then Alpha used to talk about seconds and inches. And all the nights we drove home like this, all the nights we didn't know how we drove home, how you passed out and just missed the edge of the coffee table, the ODs that you wake up out of, all the suicide attempts, the seconds and inches that we're lucky to sit in here tonight. Because it's not everybody who gets a chance to sit in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and know what their problem is. And that there was seconds and inches for me. And one more thought, you'd have another speaker. And I finally got to be what I wanted to be, what I'd been working towards, you know, because after the word victim was my name, and that's what I was really good at being, was a victim. And going into surgery that day, I heard the voice again. I see, I'm incapable of being honest with myself without the program. I just am. There's too many people that live there. I have too many layers of veneer to work through. Because I believe that day there was some truth that I was listening to that wasn't me. It was a power greater than me. And what that voice said to me, it's not your father's fault that you're lying on the gurney. It's not those guys. It's not they didn't do this to you. George, who broke your heart at 18, your sister, the Mensa you had to follow in school, that Catholic God, any of that stuff. All those broken hearts and broken dreams. You did this to you. I didn't want to hear that bit of truth because I don't know what to do with truth. I have absolutely no idea what to do with truth. I have no answers in my life. And I heard it. And during the course of the next 2 weeks as I lay in that hospital, something changed in my psyche. Something was shifted in me that I didn't quite understand. I didn't know I was getting ready to be given the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. Something shifted and changed. And when I got out of that hospital, I had nowhere to go. See, another miracle happened. Nobody sent me an airline ticket. Nobody sent me any money. Nobody said, let's go start over here. It was, there were no more answers. And I lived with this guy above a liquor store in West Los Angeles because he felt sorry for me. And he would buy me a gallon of red wine every day before he'd go to work, because I'm on a liquid diet. I have all these wires all over my face. And I have to go to court. They caught these guys. I can't leave town. And the doctors are in Palm Springs, so I have to drive back to them. And on and on and on. And I was really tired is what it was. I was very, very tired. And he'd buy me this red wine, I'd stick a straw on the top of the cheap red wine, I'd stick a straw through the wires in my mouth where the tooth had been, and suck on this red wine. And there was no more answer in alcohol. I didn't even like the taste of it anymore. August 20th, he told me I had to leave. And I called my mother. And my mother had heard something had happened to me, and it took my sister from New York 2 days to find me in this hospital that I was going to be okay. For 2 days, my mother did not know how bad I was or what was going on. She was worried sick about me. But she released me and let me go to her God. She'd never been to Al-Anon and has no idea about the program, but what she said to me that day changed my life, because I said, "Mom, I need some help. I need some money." She said, "Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army?" Seconds and inches. Mom would have sent $24. She'd have another speaker tonight. Because the next call I made was to a girl named Chris I had met in Barney's Beanery. She was the first member of Alcoholics Anonymous I had ever met. She had a big book under her arm. She was too drunk to drive. They called her a taxi to go to A&A out of this bar. And she was always nice to me. And I called Chris that day and I said I needed help. And she said, "I know, Sharon, but I can't help you." I found out later she wasn't sober that day. And she turned me on to a woman named Suzanne, who, when I called this woman on the phone, she said, "Put down your joint and put down your glass of booze." It's like, how does she know? Read my mail. I put it down, I sat there and listened for the next instruction. I don't know about you, but my first contact with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got direction. She said, "Go sit on the steps of that liquor store, and I'm sending two girls over to get you." So I did. I went and sat on the steps of the liquor store, waiting to see what was going to happen next. I had absolutely no idea. And this Volkswagen pulls up, and these two bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, California-looking beauties got out. And I'll tell you, I hated them immediately. I hated them. Well, what do they want with me? Well, I feel like I got a lot to offer, right? They rolled me in the back of this Volkswagen, and they were sincere because I smelled bad. And they seemed to be obsessed about themselves. They talked about themselves incessantly. Nobody asked me about me. You know, I had this newspaper clipping in my blue jeans in case they'd ask me what happened to me. I could pull out this thing from the Palm Springs paper and show them what happened to me, mea culpa, you know. I don't know, it just seemed like I drove a long ways. It was hot and I couldn't get out and the windows didn't open and I just sat there and they took me to this church. And I were walking up the stairs and this man with a tie on looking very nice, very official. I thought, oh, you know, where are we going? He said, "Welcome." And that was my first contact with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in a meeting, was the word "welcome." Now, I didn't know anything was going to happen that night. I didn't know anything was going to happen for 2 weeks. I was really rummy. I didn't quite get it. I was coming to A&A. I didn't get it. I just kept getting picked up and dropped off. I just went along with the game. But at my first meeting, I don't remember much what was said other than the man said that he was ready for the spaceship to land and say, "You can come home now, boy," you know? And I was one of those kids in Iowa who looked for the mothership. They dropped me off. Come and get me. You know, I knew that, and I identified. And then I saw this big blue book, and I thought, okay, where's the holy water? You know, where's the potential test? When's it going to cost me something? And it never did. You know, I sat there for a long time and waited for the other shoe to drop. And I passed the 20 questions with 17 and made this man that looked like my grandfather happy, you know. They raised my hand for me, you know. They put me right in front, you know. I've got a broken jaw. I look like a raccoon. My hair hadn't been combed. It was long and stringy. I'm coming out of my blue jeans. My T-shirt had bleach stains all over it. My broken shoes were, you know, barely on my feet. And they were, like, proud of me. They didn't make me go sit in the kitchen until I looked better, you know. Only in Alcoholics Anonymous, the sicker you are, the sicker you look, the more proud they are of you, you know. I didn't know any of this was going on. I just thought they're going to want something from me eventually. And they said, "All we want from you is not to drink and use in between meetings, and we'll pick you up tomorrow night." So that was the rule. So that's what I did. And the beauty was I got God's grace that night. The beauty was I didn't even think of drinking that night or smoking a joint. And I had never even wanted to stop drinking or stop you. Whatever I wanted when it came to alcohol or drugs, I got. And that night, I didn't even think of it. And I slept like a baby. And we did this for a while. And then they moved me out of the liquor store because they were tired of sitting there waiting for the lights to go off. Their sponsor said, "Now you wait for the lights to go off before you send her upstairs, you know?" That's love. You know, I just thought they liked me, and they sat there for a long time and talked to me until the lights went off, you know? But they were under sponsored direction. And I'm from a group called the Pacific Group, and they believe in action. And we work with newcomers, and we try to help them and give them a chance. And they were doing that for me, and I didn't even know it. They would give me change, you know, and tell me that to call my sponsor when I was trying to beg somebody for a ticket to go back to New Orleans so I can get my clothes, you know, just a bus ticket. I didn't have enough worth to think I could get an airplane ticket out of anybody anymore. And they would laugh and say, call your sponsor, kid, and they give me change. And I'd say, I can't accept this. And they'd say, just take it. I know you have no money. And someday, when you have money, you can give it to a newcomer. I don't want it back, but pass it along. That's the way you pay me back. God, that was great, because I'm a scorekeeper. You know, you do something nice for me, I got to do it back for you. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it comes back tenfold. There's absolutely no way to keep score here. I have learned how to pass it along. And it was such a freedom to know that. Okay, someday then when I get 76 cents, I'm going to give it to a newcomer. You know, and that was okay. It allowed me to accept your gifts because I had absolutely no worth. I got a sponsor because the guy with a Texas accent and a tattooed chair kept sticking his finger in my chest. Kept saying, you better get a sponsor or you're going to get drunk. And I didn't like Michael or his accent. So I got a sponsor, you know, just to get him off my back. And I found out motives didn't count, you know, because what happened was I moved from a floor to a couch, just like that when I got a sponsor. That was a spiritual experience. You get a sponsor, your life gets better. Yeah. And I loved that couch. It was great. But she made me do something, like get on my knees and say a little prayer at night. Thank you for all you've given me. Thank you for all you've taken away. And thank you for all you've left me. She had to write that down for me so I could remember it. I had to read 3 pages of the book a night. I couldn't even do that. Just the black. I couldn't remember what I had just read. I was very rummy. I was one of those newcomers, when you ask me how I was, you better have about 2 minutes to wait for the answer. Because I had a Rolodex brain, you know, one that spins and spins and spins. And it's like a question like, how are you? And I have to spin and spin and spin. And I would land on a card, you know, and I would read the card, you know. And I was very creative with my answers. It was always fine, you know. Always the answer was fine. And but people were kind to me. And a man said to me, you know, you look tired. Why don't you take your pack off and stay with us for 30 days? He said, no, you look really tired. Why don't you stay with us for 90 days? And it was an invitation. I hadn't been invited anywhere except on the back of that motorcycle because I weighed 170 plus pounds in a long time. It was an invitation. And the people seemed nice. So I kept coming back, and I didn't drink any between meetings, and the sponsor had me start doing things, and things I didn't understand, but I did them anyway because I was living in her house. And out of courtesy, I did it. And the court went okay, and the thing with the doctors went okay, and the wires came off the face, and I went back to work, and they wouldn't let me be a bartender, so I became a food waitress. And if you have a bad attitude as a food waitress, you don't make much money, so they asked me one night, I was working the graveyard shift. I was at a Saturday night meeting in my orange and brown uniform. I will not wear orange to this day. And they said, well, how are the tips, Sharon? And I went, crappy. That wasn't the word I used. And they said, well, you know, why don't you just kind of fake it till you feel it? I said, well, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're supposed to be honest in all our affairs. And, you know, I was telling people when they asked me how I was, you know. Strangers on the street, you know, that people would run away from me with funny looks. And I remember going on interviews and taking my 4-step practically with these people. And I didn't know that you could kind of fake it out there in the world, you know. And so they taught me how to do an Al-Anon smile, you know, and those nice teeth again. It works, doesn't it, Al-Anons? It works. My tips got better, you know. They would ask me how I was. I would say, fine, thank you, how are you? And it worked. People started sitting in my station again. My tips got better. They said, leave your mind in the car and go to work, you know. Just put the body there. That's all you got to do is show up with 8 hours with a good attitude. But I would have those days of, you know, I had the brain tumor. You know, I would have to go to work at 6 in the morning, so I'd call my sponsor at 5:30 and say, I can't do it today. I think I have the brain tumor. First of all, I'm waking her up, which is a wrong thing to do with a half-Mexican, half-Indian sponsor, and who's 5 feet tall and vivacious, and big mouth on her. And she would tell me, fine, Sharon, you know, go ahead, die in your bed at home, and we won't give you an AA funeral, but if you go to work, we'll give you an AA funeral, and she'd slam the phone down, you know. Yeah, she ticked me off. She made me mad. Janet made me mad the first 4 years I was sober. You know, I did a lot of things just to show her she was wrong. Motives don't count. I'm from an action-oriented group. What happened was I ended up suiting up and showing up for my life, and life started to become tenable. You know, I started to kind of enjoy myself, forget about me during the course of the day, and I'd just be working and going, gosh, that was kind of a nice day. You know, I was so into self and self-obsession that you know, I had to be pulled out of it with my anger. I mean, anger worked for me. I'm going to prove her wrong and do everything she said so I can call her up and say, you were wrong. And to this day, I've yet to call up my sponsor and say, you were wrong. Because if I can turn this sick head over to somebody who has air between me and them, between me and me is too much stuff. Between me and a sponsor, someone who knows my life is air, and they can make some good decisions for me when I need to. And my life got better because of this, because of sponsorship. I think I was about 3 months sober and I met him. At 2 years of sobriety, we got married. I was 2 years and 2 months sober, and my father and my sisters came out to the wedding. And by then, I had been through the first 5 steps. I didn't work 6 and 7 for a number of years because I didn't have any defects of character. They were all his. But I had done my inventory at 11 months of sobriety instead of having my slip, because I wanted to have my slip, and I heard everybody talk about it. I learned from my slip, and I'm so glad I had my slip because of this, because of that. And I started to hear that and listen to that, and I am not writing my inventory. I can't do it. It's too hard. I can't remember where I was. I'd sit down and hyperventilate, and I would try to put everything into order, and I would get scared, and I would get mad, and I would walk away from this piece of paper, and I would ask everybody how to do it, and they'd scream at me because I asked them 5 minutes ago, and I got mad at everybody, and I started hearing about slip, 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 and I got a credit card in the mail. I thought, it's God's will. So I ended up at the airport that night, and I thought I'd call her just one more time and tell her goodbye and thank you, and I'll be back after I have my slip. Well, she was ready for me. You know, they got a sponsor school, and gonna have a slip at the airport. See Stella's story, you know, and she flipped to that. She said, fine, Sharon, go ahead, have your slip. Don't finish your inventory. Be like my friend Stella, who did the same thing. She wouldn't finish her inventory either, went out and had her slip at 11 months of sobriety. Stella was a beautiful girl with long raven hair. Stella burned up in a bed. Never got back to tell us about her slip, but go ahead, go have fun. Well, she ticked me off. I ended up at the airport that night buying a notebook and sitting at the coffee shop drinking cup of coffee after cup of coffee and smoking my cigarettes and writing because she made me so mad. And the beauty of it was the anger overtook the fear. And I almost finished it that night. But I got so much of it down and I felt some hope again. And a week before my birthday, I took my 5th step with her and I found out that I'm not alone. No big things happened, except when I took my cake, I felt like I deserved it. And at 2 years of sobriety, when my dad came out to the wedding and saw all of you, because we had an AA wedding with two ex-Catholics, a Baptist minister, with a day at a time putting the vows, Amazing Grace sung, ham sandwiches, and a newly sober rock and roll band, you know. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And he looked around at the end of the day and he said, Sharon, look at your life. If you think about doing what you were doing before, think twice. You've got it made. God, my father was giving me approval. You know, I thought the angels were going to sing right then and there. But what happened was my head said, you know what? You're right, Dad. I have a good life. I'm on the right track. I had some of my own approval finally. So it was icing on the cake. It wasn't the whole enchilada. And I had done my written amends with my father, and it made about this much difference. I still couldn't talk alone one-to-one. When I call home and my mom wasn't there, it was a very short conversation. Unless it was a 3-way conversation, it was very short with my dad. It was still very tense. It was still very nervous. And he bought the big book when he was out here and went to a meeting with me, and he 12-stepped a couple of people because he's kind of one of those men in my hometown where people come to when they have problems. And he told a couple they were alcoholics and to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of them is still sober today, and they are educated when it comes to the disease of alcoholism. But I got a sponsor named Jenny when I was about 5 years sober, and we started working on my character defects. We started looking at me. You know, the night I hit my husband on the head with the flashlight because he was drawing a picture and he was under the headset not paying attention to me, as the flashlight came up from his head, I looked at it and I went, this is anger. I mean, I finally connected it. I was so short-circuited that finally the circuits were starting to come together, and I was beginning to have these spiritual flashes, you know. And we started to be able to work on me, and she had me do something else. So she had to call my dad and ask him how much money I owe him. I said, the nerve. How do you know I owe him some money? I said, I know, Sharon. Well, okay. So I called him up, and I thought, well, you know, he'll be kind about it. Like I said, he had been out here, and he had bought the big book, and I'm sure he was just waiting for me to call. Because I asked my dad how much money I owed him, and my father, the Capricorn, did not even drop a beat. He gave me a figure, you know. I know he had a calculator tape in that big book, you know. Bottom line, if Sharon calls, give her this figure, you know. So I got a little resentful about that, and I called her back, and I said, you know how much you said it was. She said, you're probably getting off light, and call back in a couple of days, and let's talk about how much you can afford. And so we talked about that, and she said, call him back in a couple of days and ask him about the terms. And remember, you're an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and be nice. So I called him back in a couple of days, and I thought, well, he'll remember I didn't go to Europe like the rest of the children. I paid for most of my own wedding. I never finished college. He never bought me a car when I was 16. I just took a bunch, you know. And nope, it didn't make a difference. My dad accepted my terms, and I hung up the phone. I called her back, and he said yes. And she said, okay, make out your envelopes, and without fail, on the first of every month, you send him that check, and it's not to be late, because you are an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, all right, we'll do this one check at a time. She said, oh, by the way, with your check, would you put a note about your life and some newsy little stuff about what you're doing? I said, Jimmy, he doesn't care. She said, I don't care. You do it anyway. Because I have sponsors that believe in action, not how I feel. Nobody sits around and takes my emotional temperature and worries about me. They get me into the action of living the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did this year after year, and I'm into my third year of sending this check and these notes to my dad. And some months I didn't have it, you know, and she'd say, send it anyway. He's putting it into a trust fund so that you can buy your Jaguar when this is all done, you know, and that changed my attitude, boy. I sent it early, you know. Smart sponsors. I'd send it early for a couple of months, you know. And so the end of about 3 years' time frame was during the holidays. It was between Christmas and New Year's, and my husband said to me, your dad's on the phone. I thought, oh, my God, who died? And my dad said, happy holidays, Sharon. He said, you know, your dad is free and clear with me. You don't have to send me any more checks. But don't stop sending me your notes. And two little Christmas elves cut those chips right off my shoulder. And I was able to walk into a guilt-free relationship with my father for the first time ever. And I can be his little girl today. And I can be his friend. And I can be somebody who gets along with him on an all-day basis when we go to hardware stores. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the freedom to be Daddy's little girl. And I had to start praying to a God. The first Christ God was Beacon's Moving Van. I don't know what yours was. But it worked, you know. It's just, I felt like one of those pieces of furniture that's gotten a little bit scarred and the knobs fell off and the drawer's crooked and, you know, but the Beacons wraps them in those little quilts and moves them to a new part of the country, and that's kind of felt like about my life, you know, and I was a little scratched and a knob was off here and there, but I made it to my destination. So I prayed to Beacons. You know, it makes sense if you're in your first year. I know you know what I'm talking about, but if you're an old-timer, you're going, what is she talking about? But I'll tell you, the other day I was in my law firm, and I'm looking at this cart, and they gave me a promotion a week ago, and like, as soon as they gave me this promotion, I know it was coming, I got depressed. You know, everybody's telling me congratulations, and I'm giving them the Al-Anon smile again, saying thank you, you know. You know, I just got depressed. I thought it was what I want, and it's not either, you know, and this means I'm on the right road. But I saw this Beacons box in one of those carts one of the guys was pushing down the hallway, and I just thought, it's going to be okay. I mean, it just made me feel better, you know. Whenever I see a Beacons truck, my son points them out to me. Look, Mom, God, you know. And that But I had to find a God that was more of my own understanding and more on a level that was loving me and healing me and within me. At 7 years of sobriety, I stood at a podium and I felt finally, from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, like a complete human being. There was no big piece of plate glass stopping the feelings. I felt the Spirit all the way through me, and I thought, God, this is why people stay sober. It's for this feeling of wholeness and this feeling of Spirit within, and the feeling I get when I come with you in the fellowship, because I can read my big book at home in my room and I can feel real good and I can pray and meditate and I can feel real good, but when I come together with another alcoholic, there's something special that happens, because you're my family of understanding. I have a family of blood, but you understand where I've been because you've been there, and you just can't match that. And I need to be with the fellowship and that magic spirit that we all get when we come together. The energy in this room is incredible. It's because we should be laying home in our own vomit or dead 6 feet under, and we're here living life with a chance, with a gift, seconds and inches. And my life got real good for a while. My husband stopped being a punk rocker and came back to AA after I went to Al-Anon. And what happened was I got pregnant. We went backpacking in the High Sierras and got rained in. And what happened was I got pregnant and had to do something, you know. And I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I wanted to do that. And on June 23rd, 1984, my son was born. And I knew there was a God because I took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hits of LSD. And I abused myself with alcohol and drugs. And my son has all his fingers and all his toes. And I knew there was a God again that day. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous were there to celebrate my joy. You don't have to even go through labor alone if you don't want to. You know, I had a baby in there that had survived full bliss, so I knew I was going to be okay. And, you know, my husband and our family friend was there, and the photographer was there, and his sponsor was there, and two of my babies were there, and Wesley was born and all of that, and I was a very happy camper that day. And my sponsor Clancy came to the hospital the next day and brought me a gift and told me how beautiful my son was, and I was touched by the joy of Alcoholics Anonymous. For a year and a half, I was a housewife and a mother and terribly happy. My sponsor, Jimmy, of 21 years, got off a plane from Paris with 21 days. And she has 7 years now, but I had to go get another sponsor. So Clancy became my sponsor. And I had watched him the whole time I had been sober. I had hated him a lot of that time. But he was always a motivator. He's always out there carrying the torch high. He's always working with others, and he's giving Alcoholics Anonymous away for fun and for free. And he never sleeps. He's just constantly giving away to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he has a lot of fun. 33 years of sobriety, and he's still having a lot of fun. You know, meeting Nancy and Bob and a lot of the old-timers here that are here tonight. They're not sitting at home reading their big book alone. They're here, and I admire that, and I love you for that. I'm so glad, because I want to be like you when I grow up. I want to be giving it away, feeling the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, hopefully, a day at a time when I'm 40-some years sober, Nancy, just like you. Thank you for being here. At a year and a half, my son's a year and a half old, and my husband left, and I couldn't hang on his leg, and I couldn't tell that newcomer on the phone that I'm working with to feel good about herself and say in the mirror 3 times a day, I like you, and hang on his leg and be a doormat. It didn't work anymore. I had to let him walk. And the beauty is that nobody had to drink and nobody had to leave, but it was very painful for a year and 1 month and 14 days. And I felt betrayed because there was another woman in the wings in his life, and she was newer than me and chubbier than me. And she played on a softball team, was one of my motivators for re-upping after my son was born. I joined a team that played her team, and she's a left-handed hitter, and I went out and tried for and got the position of second base, and guess where lefties hit? And we were at the Oxnard Tournament of General Service, and they have ball tournaments, and we were playing her team. And at the end of this inning, her team stood up and gave me a standing ovation, because not one of her balls got by me. Ever. Yeah. Ever.
I got hit in the mouth and it didn't matter.
Motives don't count, you know? It was one Saturday night. I had been doing some very self-destructive things in my life. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous did my resume for me. They walked me at my job interviews. They helped me get a job. They drove me to meetings where I stood at the podiums and just cried because I was so betrayed. I was so hurt. I didn't trust anybody. But at 4 a.m. when I wake up in the fetal position screaming and crying, I knew there was a God. No matter what has gone on in my life since I have had that awakening as a result of these steps, I know there's a God. I know that I don't have to be alone anymore. And it's in all of the pain, I knew I was going to be okay. It ticked me off sometimes, but I knew I was going to be okay. But the people at Alcoholics Anonymous just showed me up and helped me through that year. And I had a little resentment about Saturday nights because everybody seemed to be with him. And it seemed like they were over in the corner one night being too happy, my ex and his new her. And I had 2 hot cups of coffee in my hand that just seemed to appear. And I was on my way to see how spiritual they were because I had heard that works, you know. And it happened to be a Saturday night meeting that my sponsor was in town. And he's not in town a lot on Saturday nights, but he was there and he saw my coffee and he saw my trajectory and he stopped me. Midstream, and he took the coffee out of my hands, put them on the table, and grabbed me by the shoulders and looked me in the eyes. And he said, "Sharon, you will be an example of dignity and grace for others." And I heard him. I heard him because I sponsored people. And I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard what he said. So I just kind of gave up the extra keys to my ex-husband's car. I told on myself of all the destructive things I had been doing. I started working on myself by working steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 with him. That week I started. And then I could look at my own defects and look at where I went wrong instead of pointing the finger at them like I was doing. And 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days later, I was sitting in the Catholic Church. I've made my amends to the Catholics. Now, they seem to be peaceful and loving. I don't know where I got all those ideas about them, but I even sponsor a nun. It's really great to tell her to have faith, you know. So I was waiting for her in church one day. It was Ash Wednesday, and I felt the healing. I felt full of God's Spirit again from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes because I had felt that plate glass there that last year. And I knew something. After looking back on that experience, I knew something. I knew that I wasn't thrown out in the woods. I thought I was thrown out in the woods for that year. And I was all alone, and I was feeling sorry for myself, and wearing my black, and being mea culpa, and all self-pity, and me, and me, and me. And what I found out was, you know what, I was in a hallway. That one door just closed in my life, and the other one, I wasn't in sight yet, and so I had to sit in the hallway for a while. And now, after that experience, I know that I'm not the only one in the hallway. That you're in the hallway too, going through your problems, waiting for the door to open for you. You know, the hallway means growth, and sometimes the hallway means pain. But I've learned how to put down some throw pillows, hang some art, crack open a window, and talk to you about why you're in the hallway. Why are you here? And be happy for so-and-so who got through the door yesterday, you know? Because I know my turn's coming. A lot of living life in the sobriety is being in the hallway, because the other door always opens. It always does. And when I walked through that door after 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days, I was literally rocketed into a fourth dimension in my life than I ever dreamed possible. Inside. I have a lot of the outside happy things too, but inside. My son had a tough time with this, even though he was too young. He went through some tough stuff, and I am friends with my ex today, and his now ex too. My ex-stepwife, I call her. And it's funny, the other night we were all at a meeting, he came up and handed us each an envelope, which was something about, you know, something he read in Xerox about raising children, because she's got a baby too by him, and we both have boys. And we both opened this envelope and looked at one another and kind of like, mine doesn't have money, does yours? But thank God, with the program and with Alcoholics Anonymous, we can have this extended family together from time to time. And my son went through a tough time with his father not living with us. And I was going through a crazy time. And everything was, you know, I had to call a lot of single parents in Alcoholics Anonymous and ask them how to do this because he got kicked out of his kindergarten where he was going to school. They asked me to not bring him back. He was hiding in the parking lot. And that was okay, but he was then starting to bring the compadres with him in the parking lot. And it got a little dangerous. And my son was in kindergarten folding his arms and throwing out his feet and having a bad attitude. And I almost lost him. And I had to change some things around in my life and give him some priorities and make him important and love him like a newcomer and get a lot of help from a lot of the single parents in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I gave him to my nun I sponsor's school. She's the principal of the school. And I said, let's try this. And he feels secure and happy, and he just had a whole attitude change. And those nuns are loving him and teaching him and taking good care of him while I'm at work during the day. And he says things to me like, gee, I'm glad I picked you, Mom, to be my mom. And last year at the end of first grade, they were doing a lot of reading, and he won the reading rally. He got an award. Forgot, what's it going to be like if he ever does anything in track? I mean, God. He doesn't like me to tell people about it because it's not cool, you know, it's not soccer. But he got the reading award in first grade and got this book and this little certificate, and I was so proud. And they were reading A.A. Milne and Winnie the Pooh, and she lets them know who the authors are. So my son, of course, shot up his hand, and he has to tell Miss Ann and all the classroom that he knows A.A., his mommy's in A.A., and you know, I thought the first graders looked at me funny that day when I picked him up. You know, I found out later why. But he's proud of me, you know. He's proud of who his mom is. And I thank you for that. Because I could be a tequila-drinking, slob, self-pitying, morbid, sad human being raising a child. And I get a chance to do it sober. Thank you. When I got to Maine and Westwood after my grandfather, I never got to say goodbye to my favorite grandfather. He died in the hospital when I was too high to go tell him goodbye. And I got to name him after my grandfather, Wesley. And I healed that. Alcoholics Anonymous is full of healings. I had to go get a real job, and that's when I started working at the law firm over 4 years ago. And they don't know who I am. They say, good morning, how are you? I tell them, fine, thank you, how are you? I don't tell them. You know, if I can get on the phone and talk to one of you, we have a good laugh about my head or your head, we're okay again. And I can go out in the world I still don't understand and do pretty well. And feel at the end of the day that I've contributed a little bit. See, I'm a functioning member of society today. I even vote so that I can complain. Motives don't count. You know, they just don't count. Like I said, I got to go back to see my parents at the 50th anniversary and put this party on for them where 300 people came with my brother and my sisters. And 300 people came to have a tribute to my parents. And I was so proud to be a member of that family. And I never thought that would happen. I was so proud to be just a member of the state of Iowa. I never thought that would happen. And 2 years ago, I went home to talk at a conference and make my amends. And I was sitting at a table in my parents' house, and my mother was cooking, and my father was reading the paper, and my son was playing with his Legos. And I was listening to the locusts out. It was a hot August night, and watching the fireflies and smelling the good food, and a feeling came over me, a feeling of peace within that family. And I had a feeling that I just never thought I would have, that I belong there. And that's another healing in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's full of healings. We have a lot of fun here, but the seriousness of the disease is that Chris, who got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't call her on my birthday and tell her thank you, because she died at 30 years old, an old, old, old woman of the disease of alcoholism. One more hospital, one more time. And she was in a wheelchair, and she didn't look like herself. Her face was pocketed and blotchy, and there was nobody home in the eyes. And she didn't make it here. And I love to watch the newcomers come in and nobody's home in the eyes. And then one night you look at them and there's something different about them. And you look in those eyes and you wonder, what is it? And then you see that the light is on. You know, the switch is on the inside. I can't reach in and pull it. I can't do that. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the light is on in our eyes tonight, and we're here because of seconds and inches and God's grace. And I want to thank you again for having me.